Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Portfolio manager Dan DuPont joins us today. Dan manages all or portions of Fidelity Canadian Large Cap Fund, Northstar, monthly income and income allocation. In this podcast, he discusses his downside protection focus investment style and how he is currently investing in the oil and gas sector. He also shares his thoughts on the gold trade and why it now might be time to take a pause. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets is frequently changing. Today's podcast was recorded on September 8th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
A very warm welcome to you, Dan DuPont. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to see you again back here. We'll remind everyone to send in their questions for Dan. That Q&A button is for you to use. Send them in and we'll put them to Dan throughout the course of today's next 30 minutes or so on the show. So Dan, it looks like sort of a classic sell-off at this point, obviously sparked by tech, but there's sort of a broad-based sell-off here. Is this from sort of a downside protection value investor? Is this music to your ears or were you already there?
Well, I'd say the last year has been an acceleration of a trend that we've seen over 7-8 years. So today's, you know, it's a correction. Last week was, the tech sector is back to where it was 4 or 5 weeks ago. So I don't think anybody should be jumping up and down about this. But it's just giving us an opportunity to reposition as usual. You know, if you're nimble, if you know your stocks, if you know where you're interested, sometimes the market will give you a first or second or third opportunity to buy a security. So I'd say this is probably a day like this. I have a decent amount of oil and gas in my funds, and I was just trying to punch a trade just before this webcast. Not going to say which stock or whether I was going to buy or sell, but I think people on the webcast can have an idea of what I was trying to do.
So interesting. So there's opportunities opening up. I mean, let's go to commodities first. We see the U.S. dollar actually edging back up after a slide because there seems to be a little bit of a concern. And we've seen oil drop, but there are lots of reasons why oil could be dropping. We still don't have a whole lot of capacity. What do you like about oil right now?
Oh, I just, I think it's one of those situations where if you have a little bit of a slightly longer time frame, I mean, most people in our industry are driven by career risk. They don't want to look wrong for the next 3 months. I'd say if you look out 2-3 years, it's, in my view, it's pretty obvious that oil, I mean, and that's what the oil curve is telling us, that oil will rebound to 45, 50, 55, to a point where a lot of these companies will have significant free cash flow generation capabilities. They have disavowed, spending CapEx on new wells because they've been pummeled enough by their investors not to ever to do that ever again. So growth is out of the picture. Nobody wants to finance these companies anymore. So, private equity has been burnt. 3 years ago, they went all in. 2017, 2018, private equity tried their hand at oil and gas. They got decimated. And there's no bank left that wants to lend to an oil and gas company. So all of that may sound a little bit bearish, but honestly, it's actually very, very bullish for the typical oil company, mostly if you're one that has a very strong balance sheet and very high quality assets. So there's quite a few of those in Canada. That's why my tilt, and they're cheaper too in Canada, which is, it's pretty rare that that's the case. So a lot of oil and gas, a lot of Canadian oil and gas in the funds.
Because, you are speaking literally to the, and I know this is how you invest and you are contrarian in that sense, but I mean, a lot of people are staying away from this.
Yeah. Well, yes, I am contrarian. I am at heart, and before everything else, I'm a downside protection investor. I'm certainly not fundamentally a value investor. But values underperformed growth for basically the last 9 years, every single year. I think it's more than 8 years, depending on who you ask, obviously, but it's been a long time and it's accelerated. And so there are points in the cycle, there's points in time when you need to really do the work, and eventually, even if it's slightly lower quality, as a company, it's so cheap that the math compels you to ultimately get involved. So oil and gas, for example, was very cheap last year. And if I had been a value investor, true and true, I would have bought a lot of oil and gas and I would have bought a lot of financial. But that trend just kept going. And luckily for us, the process that I'm following is not a value process. It's a downside protection process. So when these stocks that eventually become value, stay value, get better and better and better and better value, cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, ultimately they get cheap enough for me to get interested. And that has been concentrated in a few sectors, including oil and gas and financials, and that's why we're more concentrated there now.
Okay, so let's go to financials then. So financial, I mean, Canadian financials were at book, in the last few months. Some of them come up somewhat substantially. Where are you looking at financials at this point?
They're kind of middle of the road now. I'm not super excited about them. I mean, I made some really big purchases in March. We can discuss that now because it's been enough months. But there were some massive dislocations in the Canadian market. There were some, without getting into too many details, there were some products that were structured probably mostly for high net worth individuals. But there were some notes and things that got triggered that forced a lot of selling in that third week of March. So we were able to buy gigantic blocks. As the investors in my funds know, I am the first call when there's big blocks that come to market, because in the Canadian market, there's pretty much nobody else that can buy hundreds of millions of dollars of securities within a minute or two, without asking permission from a committee overnight. So when these blocks came to market at 3:20, 3:20, 3:30, which is probably, the margin call is coming. There's nobody else that could buy, hundreds of thousands of shares of CIBC and Royal and TD and Power Corp. And so that was a really nice place to be. That's how we got to 0% cash in Canadian large cap. We started the year at 30%. I've been very high in liquidity for many years because I couldn't find enough good ideas to populate the fund. And in March, I got there through transactions like that. So the banks were, as you said, they got to basically book value, not all of them, but some of them did. And they have rebounded somewhat since then, but not that much. So they're still somewhat attractive. I think the uncertainty around loan losses, around net interest margins, it's still there. It's still keeping a lot of people away, but they're not as cheap as they were in March.
So,
But
what are
that's
your?
the Canadian side, though.
Oh, that's the Canadian side. Okay, we'll go into that further. But just because you were talking about the kind of cash you were deploying, what are your liquidity levels at now that you can talk about?
Started the year around 30, maybe even more than 30, adjusted for everything, arbitrage, which is basically a cash equivalent, and I had some T-bills, but including all of that, I was over 30. We bottomed at zero in March, and got a few inquiries about that from a few people that thought that was weird for me, and whether I was being a little reckless because obviously the market was going lower, and lo and behold, it just bounced, because you never know. The market just does its own thing, and if there's enough cheap stocks to buy, you just buy them and you push forward. That's what we did. And since then, some of the securities that we bought bounced hard enough that we sold them. We bought back some shares that were really cheap, so made some positions bigger, but we're still probably around 6-7% liquidity. But the market is bifurcated enough at this point for me to be almost fully invested as I am right now. We
So
are
is
seeing the market go up every day, but until last week, but there were spots where there were attractive.
Does it stay, Dan DuPont, bifurcated? I mean, are we in the midst of watching, as we said in the introduction, is this a healthy sell-off so that the rotation comes? I mean, is this that point, or can you shed any light on this for us?
My time frame is not a week or two. I don't know if this reversal lasts a week or a month. But all I know is if you take a step back, there's a few points in history when we see giant divergences in the market, economies that are not sustainable. Now, in 2000, if you had talked about small cap, if you had talked about gold, you'd have been laughed out of the room. And it was the exact time to do that. Small cap and foreign stocks. And then in 2007, if you said, well, maybe we should just, pull back on some of these financials, they've done really well. No, housing can never correct. It wasn't as extreme then, but emerging markets in 2013, and I was presenting to hundreds of people and saying, you should get out of emerging markets. They've done really, really well. I don't think your risk reward's really good. And people would come after presentations, and they would just push back a lot. There was a lot of belief in the idea that emerging markets grow faster as economies, and therefore their markets should do better, which historically has not been proven correct. But it seemed like a decent assumption to make if you did not do your homework. Now, you fast forward to today. What could be the mistake? A smart investor I follow says, you should try to find the mistake of the day and try to avoid it. And the mistake of the day, if you look at what everybody's focused on right now, is probably the idea that everyone seems to believe right now that software is eating the world, and therefore we should be comfortable paying for dozens and dozens of software companies more than 40 times sales. I mean, you take any other time in history, and that would sound absolutely ridiculous. But that's where we are now. There's no way mathematically that you're going to make money over 10 years on a basket of these companies. In my mind, it's impossible. But that's just personal opinion. It's not a fidelity opinion, my personal opinion. I think that's where we are. And that's why I need to focus where the cheapness is. I'm avoiding the mistake du jour, for sure. We're not invested in any of these high-flying technology stocks. But at the same time, I need to do my homework and be aggressive where there is opportunity. And that's in part oil and gas, financials, a little bit in European industrials. And while keeping my core of companies that's always protected us in the last 10 years. So I own some grocers, I own some telcos, and I do trade a little bit around those. If they get too expensive for my taste, I'll trim. I'll buy them when they become really, really cheap, like Empire did a few years ago. But in general, I think we take a step back. This particular correction in the last week, I don't know if it's going to stop today or in a week or if the tech stocks are going to bounce. All I know is that, your prospective return in these really, really highly priced stocks is very, very, very low.
So let's go to interest rates and let's go to something that is not cheap right now on the sort of the equity side of things, which is gold. If you're trying to buy gold companies, they've shot up. What do you think of gold? What do you think of the underlying dynamics that's been pushing it forward? Give us a sense of sort of your global view of interest rates, gold as a currency.
Well, it's not easy managing money the way I do. I always look like the patsy because I never own the cool assets when they seem to be cool. So, I owned gold a lot last year. I had 10% of my funds in gold, and I had 3% in Barrick. And ultimately, I just thought it was too difficult to forecast. I know that the fundamentals, they sound amazing when you just discuss what drives the gold price historically and where we are today. It sounds like gold should go up. But that being said, gold has gone up a lot in the last year, and could be very natural for it to take a pause. Now, if we take 30 seconds to talk about the gold fundamentals, gold is basically it's a currency, and it performs relative to real rates in the U.S. So if inflation is high and interest rates are low, that's a really good environment for gold. If interest rates are high and inflation is low, that means you could make a lot of real returns in US government bonds, and therefore you're going to shun gold and buy US government bonds instead. Now, what the central banks are saying, what the Federal Reserve certainly is saying, is you know what? We're going to let inflation run high and we're going to keep rates low for a long time. And that, in and of itself, is the most bullish environment for gold as a narrative. The problem is everybody knows that, and everybody's heard them say it 20 times. So one of the risks you're taking, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, but one of the risks you're taking is and it might just be a short-term one at some point, but if everybody rapidly believes that inflation targets are never going to get hit, and we, instead of seeing inflation expectations be in the 1% to 2% range, they go down to the 0 or minus 0.5% range, that could be a problem for gold, because then your real rates on U.S. government bonds shoots up, and gold could have a decent correction from there. But all that being said, gold companies historically have had really bad returns, even worse than oil and gas companies. So you need to buy them at a really, really cheap price, in my view, and you need to be really right on the gold price. So to me, it's not an easy thing to analyze. It's not a place where I want to be now. It's where I wanted to be last year, because to me, the risk reward looked really good. And at this point, it's so difficult to predict that I think there's a decent amount of risk in being positioned. But I totally understand the narrative, and I understand why people would want 5% of their assets in gold at this point, because there is a risk that central banks really don't know what they're doing. They've kind of proven that over the last 20 years.
I liked your throwaway comment there. So are you surprised that the TSX is a large percentage of it is gold companies right now? Or like how big their market cap is?
You know, they're expensive. They're not in bubble territory or anything like that.
Okay.
Central banks make a lot of mistakes in the next 5 years. It's going to get a whole lot bigger, unfortunately, possibly.
Because they're going to essentially keep interest rates where they are, and there's more QE. Is that why?
Well, if they lose control of inflation and they decide not to raise rates while that is going on, then that could be a problem. I would say historically, one of the signs we need to watch that one of the things I'm watching to understand the gold situation better and what the market is thinking about the fragility of the market or the system that we're in is the volatility in the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is the currency of the world. It backs, you know, over 50% of transactions between countries in the world. So, you know, that is the main thing we use for trade. If the value of the U.S. dollar becomes volatile, then I would start to really wonder what the heck is going on, because that would mean people are starting to lose confidence in the main currency in the world, and that is probably very, very problematic. But I don't think we're at that point yet, but we certainly need to be vigilant.
Okay, so let's tuck that away and ask you the questions rolling in here on several of them here for you, Dan, particularly on the U.S. election. So the question is really how do markets sort of perform around that? And how does it affect value stocks from your perspective, a U.S. election and this particular one?
I have an opinion. Let me just, before the opinion, say the way I invest is when something becomes obvious, then I will invest. If something is really difficult to predict, I'll try not to get hurt by the unpredictability. So if we look at the last election, everybody thought if Trump came in, and frankly, I wouldn't say I wasn't part of that group of people saying, well, if Trump comes in, there's a lot of uncertainty, so maybe the market goes down, and then the market just ripped higher. And so this time around, could we see another surprise, or could it just be calmer? The volatility markets are certainly thinking that this is going to be a very complicated one because of the mail-in ballots. So I'm not an expert, but I do have a few friends in Washington. We do a bunch of research internally. And it does seem like the night of the election, one possibility is that Trump will look like he won the election, and then the ballots will come in through the mail. The mail-in ballot counts will come in, and then maybe the Democrats win. And that could be where the problems come in. And so if you look at the VIX curve, which is the volatility curve, it's certainly saying people are nervous about November. So the VIX is the expected volatility on the S&P 500, and that expected volatility right now for the next few days is a certain level, but for November it's expected to be higher. So people are thinking that maybe things are going to be a little uncertain around the election. But you know, when it comes to positioning the fund, depending on who wins, at this point I think I like my particular process of positioning not to be hurt no matter what happens.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's great. Let's talk a little bit about, you were going back to, I think it was, how to not make the mistake. So you were mentioning in terms of history, emerging markets. I'm curious, remind us of the mandate, what you're allowed to go outside of North America for investments for, what if it's attractive to you globally, and just give us sort of the landscape view on that.
For large cap and concentrated value, it's maximum 49% foreign content. I am typically at 49, but right now I'm lower than 49 because I have enough entities in my view in Canada to increase that higher. In Northstar, where I manage a quarter of the fund, that fund is a go anywhere fund, so that's global. There's no foreign content.
What do you like globally?
I'd say, again, to avoid the mistake of the day, geographically, that one is also, in my view, kind of blatant at this point. It's never the easy path to take, the one that is going to give you the most, the highest prospective return. But geographically, it's pretty obvious the US has performed really well and has really, really well. And for the next 10 years, the bet to make would be that, Europe, emerging markets, and Asia, that, I mean, everything's going to outperform the US. I think that's pretty easy bet to make if you give us enough time. But yeah, I'd say geographically, for my particular funds, Europe is the biggest weight. So a lot of industrials over there that became really cheap. Asia also has a lot of idiosyncratic ideas. Philippines, I have two, three names there. Thailand, Japan and Korea. Also positions in Northstar. So, luckily we have the global research because it's a lot of work, but we've analyzed them, we know what they're valued, and we've been adding them.
I want to just come back to financials, which we were talking about before. You sort of closed out the discussion on Canadian financials, that they've obviously had this pretty big upswing from when they got ground down to book value. What about financials more broadly?
So you have to first look at the balance sheet of a financial to figure out, okay, how much trouble can I get into here? And I'd say European financials haven't cleaned themselves up quite well since the problems in 2008, 2009. They had more problems in 11, 12. And so they're still levered for some of them, 25, 30 to 1. So there's $30 of assets per dollar of equity. That's a lot of risk on a financial balance sheet. The cleanest balance sheets of all global banks, in terms of size, is the US. And they're really, really cheap as well. So US financials, depending on which subgroup you look at, but they were trading at six times, five, six times book in 2000. And ever since 2008, people have slowly but surely gotten away from them. They just don't care. They care less and less and less and less. And now you can buy US financials under book, significantly under book. For an expected return, in my view, that's pretty decent. The fear is for the next year or two, loan losses are going to be decent, although they have certainly taken a lot of them in the last 2 quarters, which, good for them. But also, interest rates are low. They are expected to remain low. The Federal Reserve has told us they're going to keep them low as well to try to get inflation higher, which puts pressure on financials, financial performance, their profitability, their net interest margins get under some pressure. But we know all of these things. And so at this point, given how cheap they are, they're really, really cheap, frankly, the surprises are probably going to be on the upside. But again, there's a bit of a time arbitrage element here. You need to look farther than the next 2, 3 months. Because obviously, there's going to be another 1, 2, 3 quarters that are going to be a little tougher than the last few years in terms of loan losses. So, if you're willing to wait for that particular tide to pass, I think, performance is going to look pretty good. But again, it's certainly not the popular place to be. But if you look at my funds and what I own, it's never the popular place to be.
Well, and it is the protection to the downside, of course, is sort of the key thing that you're looking for here. Here's a question coming in. So what is your positioning on the sleeve of North Star? That's the specific question from an advisor.
So that is mostly outside the US. So a lot of European, again, European industrials, a lot of UK. UK has a little bit like value is underperformed, from the fears of Brexit, then the Brexit vote, and then just uncertainty around Brexit. So those stocks have the same stock, the same industry. US versus UK, you'll be able to buy the UK stock significantly cheaper, even if they're both global stocks, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is.
So a lot of UK, a lot of Europe, and industrials is certainly a big focus for me. I don't own any European financials. There are one-off ideas here and there that I would share with Patrice, for example. They're in all kinds of industries, confectionery, travel, it could be even something that's related to commodities, but it's something that's some company has a proprietary product that they sell. So it's all across the board and it's global. Emerging markets is small, but it's getting a little bit bigger for me. But again, in North Star, I'm 25% of the fund. Joel is 50. So Joel has a bigger influence than I do. And frankly, given his style, you want him to be managing most of that.
I'm dying to ask if the confectionery is chocolate, but we don't have time, and I have to get in a real estate question. So
Okay.
a question on Canadian real estate. We have a 3 minutes, so you'll have to make it quick. But Canadian consumer, real estate, where are we going here?
This is going to sound like I should not have bought the banks in March, but everything has a price. The Canadian banking industry is an oligopoly. It's a well-functioning one. And therefore, it will get through pretty much anything. But it doesn't mean that there won't be bumps, and it doesn't mean that you shouldn't wait for a cheap price to buy them, which is what I did. But if you look at the facts, it's undeniable that Canadian real estate is practically the most expensive in the world. Canadian consumers are incredibly indebted. It's really difficult to figure out how this gets better. It's difficult to not see stress if house prices come down significantly. So I am positioned very lightly in Canadian banks. It's a relative to a benchmark, it's a small position. For me, anything matters. I don't really care about the benchmark. So the fact that I own banks means I am focusing on everything that's going on in the Canadian real estate markets and the Canadian consumer, which is of overwhelming importance for Canadian banks. And I monitor these two positions in Canadian banks that I have very closely. But if you look at just if your question is Canadian real estate overvalued, residential real estate, very, very overvalued. Across the country, it's worse in some areas. Will it or could it have an impact on the Canadian consumer if these prices stop rising and eventually go back down? Absolutely.
We'll have to leave it there. I'm sorry.
Not the
It's
most bullish.
less bullish. Okay. Amazing to get your thoughts. And it's so fabulous, really, to have quite a different perspective, for everyone to listen to and for advisors to ask questions of. Dan Dupont, a pleasure to speak with you from Montreal. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. Please visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.